Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. I promise we're not going to focus on the toad dick course today, but we are going to open on it. So heads up for all those who are uncomfortable with this sort of body talk or this kind of juxtaposition between toad and Donald Trump's penis. To compare the president's penis to a Mario character is merely to be the latest in a very long line of people leveraging the icons of one of the most beloved video game franchises of all time into bizarre new memes. For anyone coming at this simile as a close follower of the president, it can seem odd. For anyone who likes Mario games and uses the internet, it is the most normal thing in the world. That was from Brian Feldman in a Select All piece titled, Why We Love Thinking About How the President's Penis Looks Like Toad from Mario. And the title of that article tells you exactly what you need to know in case you didn't know already. I'm Danielle Riendo, and this is Waypoint Radio, episode 188. Joining me here today, whether they want to be or not, are Natalie Watson.
I don't love thinking about how Toad is
a
penis.
Yeah, I'm here for you. Rob Zachney.
I'm just here for the segue.
Good. Happy about it. And Patrick Klevick.
Dick, 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 dick.
I hate this already. Please eject. Austin, can I leave this now?
Okay!
Where's Austin? I need to leave.
Dick, 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 dick.
My Austin just called and he said I need to go home right now immediately.
That's correct. Like I said, I promise you, dear listener, we are not centered on the dick course today because I think it's much more interesting to look at why the Mario series, in particular, tends to inspire these kinds of references. And I'm not just talking about this one particular thing, which, again, we're not going far into, but if you were on the internet, you know what I'm talking about, and if you heard the name of that article, you know what I'm talking about. No, it's not just this. It's things like people being obsessed with Mario's nipples.
I am that girl.
You are that. Okay. Well, see, now you understand. There's a lot of adult sort of content happening. Of course, I'm also talking about Luigi's dick being 3.7 inches flaccid, which some internet historians / scientists figured out from a Mario Tennis Aces picture of Luigi. And also things that have nothing to do with sex or sexuality or bodies, like Yoshi's tax fraud meme, which is a meme where Yoshi is happily jumping, and the text upon it says, I committed tax fraud. This was around. Also things like Luigi being dead and killed by death. So there's a lot of evidence for Mario characters being used in, like, weird, bizarre adult situations that are not just limited to sex or bodies. And I kind of want to open up the floor with a question of why does this happen so often? And then we're going to get into why is it kind of funny? And then we're going to go even deeper. So, Natalie, you look like you have some strong thoughts on the matter.
Why? Because the internet is bad and likes to ruin things that I like, aka Toad, and likes to just burn it to the ground and ruin it for me forever.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I don't know. I guess there's just so little information about who these characters actually, like, who's Mario?
Who is Mario?
Who is he?
Yeah.
Who's Toad? I don't know.
Who is Toad? Well, I suppose the Super Mario Broth author might have a different opinion about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
He knows deeply.
He has not responded to the revelations of the past couple of days, and privately, when I asked, it was a emphatic no comment. So,
Eric Frosty, you know what? Good for him. Like, good for him.
He deals in facts, all right?
That's right. He deals in facts.
Was it earlier this year? I wrote a piece about Fortnite pornography, or you know, like of the drawn kind, and like the answers I got from different artists I talked to was that the reason they were drawing Fortnite pornography was because it was a blank slate, because there was nothing to inform it, and so these artists essentially got to take a cool design and then project whatever they wanted onto it, or in the case of people asking for requests, they could project whatever those people wanted onto those characters, because all you had was a striking design, and like that was it. And so I think there is a natural tendency to sexualize everything, and
yeah.
Then when you are presented, like that happens regardless of whether there is a background to a character or to a world. Like the internet will find a way to do that. Someone that'll either be someone's particular thing, or they will turn it into a thing because someone hasn't done it before. And I think, you know, this especially happens with, you know, stuff that is family focused, because the internet has a tendency to corrupt things because they find glee in corrupting things, and like zeroing in on sexual preferences and sexuality and eroticism of Nintendo, like that's like falls 100% within that ballpark.
Yeah. It's like, we found the horny in Mario
and
like
Mario's let's nipples. Yeah.
And yeah, it's something where like it feels like you're kind of, you get, it's like a sort of like an inside joke almost, where you get to just kind of revel in this like it non-obvious information, and then when that information is presented to like not oblivious, but people who are not in the know about that sort of thing, about horny Mario or whatever, you get to kind of have your own like hehehe aside or whatever, you know, like it's it's yeah, I don't know. Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Natalie's just in a reverie.
I'm overwhelmed.
Not into Mario, but somewhere I think she found, mentally she found the thing she was into. I don't know what that is, but she's like
having feelings over here.
Is that horny somewhere. Garfield thing?
Absolutely not. I'm not a part of horny Garfield fandom.
What is that cheddar goblin getting up to at night?
That I am thinking about.
Yeah, I think there's definitely that element of corrupting something that is sort of aggressively naive and not asexual is the wrong word, but it's just not sexualized. It's not supposed to be. And the Nintendo characters are such aggressively, cutely charismatic blanks that they do invite, like, imagine them in the most heinous fucking scenarios. Like, this was the premise of, like, a Robot Chicken series of sketches, right? Where, like, oh, what if Mario and Luigi were driving around and they took a wrong turn in video game land into GTA's Vice City? And it's suddenly, like, Mario and Luigi recontextualized into, you know, a city overrun with, like, drugs and violence. Like, wouldn't that be hilarious? And I think that's kind of the appeal of doing that with characters like these. The other thing is just that they're so widely recognizable, right? You know what I mean? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that's like bringing up these mascots is going to evoke something. I think that's one reason why Stormy Daniels, you know, said it. Was this is going to land. This is a burn that is going to make its way out into the wider world. Because that is immediately going to like conjure images, but also like be sort of luridly revolting.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right.
It's also extremely funny.
It is. That's the thing, right? It's very amusing. It's very evocative. I think part of it is also that it's so specific and colorful of an image. It's not just like, oh, random thing. It's like, no, this really specific toad image is really a lot. And that also has to do with things like people being horny for Mario's nipples, or like, oh my God, why isn't he wearing a shirt? Like, what's going on with this? People getting very, very, very excited for it. And it is absolutely something that is kind of fun to write, right? I remember writing a piece. This wasn't specifically about this kind of stuff, but it was about whether Mario was human or not, and sort of like getting an answer from Nintendo on that. And people were excited for that. I know that piece like did particularly well because it's like, this is a funny thing to ponder, the like humanity or a, you know, adulthood or the sort of like reality of these bonkers characters who have been around for 30 plus years, who have weird adventures and have weird backstories that sort of intermingle. Of course, there's the whole thing about how every Mario series game is about somebody ruining somebody else's vacation, like that old trope, right? Like, oh, they came to Dinosaur Island. Oh, no, they came to the tropical Isle Delfino, excuse me, pardon me. I need to make sure I get my Mario Sunshine terminology correct.
Yeah.
Another aspect I kind of wanted to get into is why the hell is everyone obsessed with who is whose father slash mother and who has reproduced whom in the Mario series? Because that continually comes up, and it comes up, and it comes up, and it comes up, and it's weird and interesting.
Well, because if you're pretending it's a world that doesn't acknowledge sex, yet there are offspring, and there's not an explanation otherwise, that it's just like they, I don't know, just gremlins, like they just kind
mitosis.
Of, like, yeah, like it just comes off their back when they get exposed to water.
Fed them after midnight.
You know, like absent a separate sort of explanation, it's like, all right, they're fucking. So,
or not. I mean, they are reproducing by some means, and we just want to answers about what those means are.
And it's because you know it makes, like, presenting those questions to a company like Nintendo, like, it's funny when they do answer, but then it's even funnier to try and pose the question to them because you know they don't want to answer, right? Like, that is part of the enjoyment of this whole thing, is knowing that Nintendo doesn't want to be dragged into a conversation about any of this. But even when they do, right, because they gave, like, a formal response about, like, someone asked them about the nipples at E3 or something like that once. And they had, like, a deeply, like, funny, interesting response. And then this is contrasted, right? Like, all this, like, fits in, like, Nintendo is decidedly non-horny, but then you have, like, the Fire Emblem series, which is deeply horny. And has leaned into that, especially in the last, 5 to 7 years, like basically starting with like the Game Boy Advance, like DS entries. Like they were like really leaning into that and the way they translated the text. I don't know how the original Japanese text goes, but like the localized versions of that, there was a lot more than wink, wink and nod, nodding happening. And so like you have a spectrum of things. It was like a game explicitly with relationships where people are trying to hook up with each other. And then a whole world of other Nintendo characters where none of that happens. And like, I think the parental stuff like fits right into that. Is people like trying to figure out the logic of a world that doesn't have logic?
Yeah, but Fire Emblem is not made by Nintendo. It's like published by Nintendo.
Oh, it's made by Nintendo. It's made by one of their internal divisions.
Oh, okay. Never mind. I didn't realize that. What I was gonna say to your point earlier, Danielle, about like I think Mario's world is so insular and it like doesn't extend outside of its own world very much, and so trying to figure out, because there are parallels to our world, right? And that's why the thing with, you know, Mario, like Mario's never really appeared in clothes other than like his classic overalls, and if he does, they're costumes that have like certain, you know, benefits, like Tanuki Mario or whatever, Fireball Mario, but they all have like reasoning behind them. So seeing Mario in like a bathing suit was like, okay, why? What's the point?
Or New Donk City, right? Like or those humans are fucking. Yeah. Are they?
Probably.
They
I don't
must
know.
Be.
They must be. But so just like trying to figure out like why or the workings of that world. It's kind of funny because I feel like we're kind of circling back to the Twin Peaks conversation that we had earlier.
Which Mario equals Twin Peaks. We got it.
Which is just that like there is a lot of arbitrariness in like in the things that, you know, people like Super Mario Broth has found. And the like different findings in game manuals and things like that. None of them, I remember Austin was talking, we were talking about this earlier, Austin was saying that there was like in one of the game manuals that blocks certain blocks were characters every that had block. Turned in. Oh, yeah, yeah. Every blocks were characters that had turned into blocks, which is information, right? But it doesn't necessarily change any. Like, you don't get to make any decisions about the way you move through the world unless you're, like, kind of making your own game out of it, if you're, like, adding it yourself. But there's nothing about the world in the world itself that's reflecting that. And so it is kind of arbitrary. It's like if you care, but it's not really going to be explicitly referenced in the world, and nor is the world really going to react to it if you decide to kind of engage with it, which is, so it is kind of like just for the player's own fun, and probably for like the developer's own fun too, like going, you know, throughout the 30 plus years or whatever of Mario, just getting to add little like, and this, like different like bits of flavor text is just like fun rather than like world building in the sense that we think of it. And we want to make that into world building. We want to make that into like a lore, a Mario lore. Well,
we exist in that world, right? Like we, like in 2018, like we exist in a world in which like we expect complete worlds that have logical connections between them. And there's even contradictions within Nintendo themselves where, like, watching them jump through hoops to explain, like, the Legend of Zelda mythology, like, where they have explicitly acknowledged that they have, like, a timeline, and the timelines of all the games sort of make sense in a retcon. Like, they are clearly retconning as they go along the way. And I think they've said in, like, recent interviews about Breath of the Wild that, like, they sort of just, like, make the game and then figure out where it fits in later. So there's a lot that happens. But, yeah, I think you're right, like, that it's like Super Mario is sort of like to him. It just is until it isn't, and that's the fun of it. But that we exist in a world of hyper-analysis, hyper-connectivity. We expect explanations for everything, or if we can't find them, there's a 45-minute YouTube video that will present a theory of how it might work. That's the lack
how
of...
How Yoshis might fuck.
Well, the lack of information is fun, right? Because, like, okay, if they actually did explain how it worked, that's way less fun, right? Like that in a lot of ways.
That's midichlorians.
Right, yeah. Like the actual answer, they're like, you know, I don't. It happens off screen and it's not gross at all. Like, that's no fun. Like, you want to like have like the weird explanation that someone jumps through hoops to figure out. And I think that's just the part of the appeal.
Rob, it looks like he got something there.
No, I was also just thinking though about like, the other thing is, the more information and context you add to these characters, though, the more they begin to have, like, an actual internal politics among themselves, but also, like, analogs to the real world. And I think Nintendo has tread very careful. Like, we joked on this podcast, I think, a while back about, like, how, you know, Toad's definitely a cop. Toad's definitely, like, some sort of collaborator who, like, upholds the regime no matter what.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But, like, there is no Mushroom Kingdom. You know what I mean? Like, they've never built that out into a world that, like, you can't imagine, like, what does Peach do as, what kind of ruler is Peach? I have no fucking clue. As far as I can tell, she's got a lot of random, like, pipes and shit, like, littering
her
kingdom.
She's got some security issues for sure. Like,
yeah,
no,
well,
question.
Of course she does, because there's nobody else in that world. Like, there's no, like, there's nobody there. It's, like, it's Toad, it's a palace, and it's a bunch of cutesy mushrooms and, like, sewage outlets just sticking out of the ground like beanstalks. Like, it's, that's what it is. And so, like, it both invites that, you know, well, I can make the argument that it's extreme, like, that actually, like, the entire universe is, like, Bowser's the good guy, and actually, like, Bowser's trying to, like, overthrow a corrupt regime. That's a fun thought experiment, because then you're like, here's me using all the tools of analysis to something that fundamentally gives you no handholds for any of that stuff. And that's why I think Nintendo can also just sort of, like, tolerate it, right? Like, because Nintendo can play, like, oblivious and hapless because in the text, there is not that much there. There isn't, and there likely never will be. And so the flip side of, like, you know, fandom abhors a vacuum is that you're just going to also have to be comfortable, and I think Nintendo broadly is, maybe until this week, comfortable with the idea that, like, people are going to read weird shit into your creation, but you have to know, like, they're not actually doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not with, like, repercussions or consequence. Like, you know, making fan theories about why, you know, or about the infrastructure developments that Peach is implementing into the future of Mushroom Kingdom, like, that's never going to affect the game itself. And so there's really no consequence to it unless you try to make your own fan-made version of that.
There's a line there. But there also is, there has to be, at least on some level, and maybe it is this week that actually hit this line, you know, unless it was something incredibly negative, right? Mario's a murderer or something, like, extremely, extremely negative, or, you know, which I am sure on the internet there's something about that.
I mean,
but it's
Mario
not like a popular
a murderer.
Meme.
He's murdering Goombas and Koopas.
You're not wrong.
They even admitted that he's punching the shit out of Yoshi.
Yeah.
That's like, true.
Mario can take it.
Mario sucks.
Well, he can dish it out, really.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, actually, I don't know.
Mario kind of sucks.
Yeah, what's going on?
I don't know about how I feel
awkward
about that man's.
It is a little awkward. There's another big question here that I kind of want to go into. And I'm going to read a little thing. But the main thing is why this is so different tonally, and I do think it's incredibly, incredibly different. We find a lot of the Mario stuff kind of funny, kind of amusing, kind of fun to play with. Whereas a couple of days ago on the internet, there was a minor kerfuffle about Sesame Street writer revealing that he always thought of Bert and Ernie as gay. So it's almost, it felt in some ways as not an official acknowledgement, but on some level, on some degree, an acknowledgement of that thing that I think a lot of people have kind of always assumed. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there was a taking back of that, and there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. But, you know, of course, there were some reductive headlines that said things like Bert and Ernie fucked. And, like, that feels gross. Like, that feels like a completely different, even though there's some surface level similarities. I'll read a little tiny bit here from a piece that talks about that just a bit. A piece called "We're Still Going to Keep Thinking Ernie and Bert Are Gay, and There's Nothing You Can Do About It" from Elle, a writer called R. Eric Thomas, just to explain sort of what happened with that. The notion that Sesame Street mainstays Ernie and Bert are more than just confirmed bachelors who split the rent in a cozy urban apartment is not new. Way back in 1994, the New York Times ran an editorial entitled, "Are Bert and Ernie Gay?" in response to letters that had been sent in to TV Guide on the subject. Someone was writing to TV Guide on paper about whether two characters from Sesame Street had a timeshare on Fire Island before Troy Sivan was even born. Like the most successful of pop culture ephemera, it's an idea that has animated the imaginations of some and stoked the outrage of others for decades. It came to a head yesterday when, for a brief moment, the internet believed it had confirmation. In an interview published on Queerty, former Sesame Street writer Mark Saltzman said, quote, "I always felt that without a huge agenda, when I was writing Bert and Ernie, they were a couple. I didn't have any other way to contextualize them," end quote. The site framed the interview as a coming out announcement, and the internet quickly picked it up. But late yesterday, Saltzman told the New York Times that his comments to Queerty had been taken out of context. Quote, "As a writer, you just bring what you know into your work," unquote. But he was notably sanguine about setting down hard and fast rules about the duo. Quote, "It's like poetry. It's what you need it to be," he said, unquote. It's a striking contrast to Sesame Workshop's strong rebuttal in a now deleted tweet. So that's just a little bit of context about what happened the other day with Bert and Ernie. The main thing I want to focus on here is why we got mad. I'm using the royal we. I'm sure other people didn't get mad, and they probably thought it was funny. But why I think a lot of other people like me, thought there's a major qualitative difference between Bert and Ernie fuck and something like the Toad dick course.
Well, it was just, part of it was just so silly because then I guess the now deleted, I didn't know that had been deleted, but the deleted tweet from Sesame Workshops, which is like the Sesame Street official Twitter,
but they deleted that tweet.
They yeah. deleted Apparently that tweet, did. Which wow. which had said that
it was extremely bad.
Yep. That's a which word, had said that's that even worse.
It makes it worse.
Muppets don't have sexuality. It was saying, it said that like Bert and Ernie are you know, friends. We wanted to show, like, you know, friendship, whatever. I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember.
As we have always said, Bert and Ernie are best friends. They were created to teach preschoolers that people can be good friends with those who are very different from themselves. Even though they are identified as male characters and possess many human traits and characteristics, as most Sesame Street Muppets do, they remain puppets and do not have a sexual orientation.
Yeah. Which is, yo.
It's, okay. Horseshit. You ever That's seen horseshit. A fucking Muppet show? Like, yeah. Okay. There's
gender
a couple...
all over the place. Gender coming out the ass. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Muppets are real. Yes. But also, for me, like, and this goes back to, the, like, especially with Sesame Street. Sesame Street characters have always operated on multiple levels. Like, in the DNA of that show, the show was about making different types of people seem not other to an audience of children.
Completely.
Easy example. Oscar is yes, he's a grouch who lives in a trash can. Oscar is also a metaphor for people who live rough on the street.
Yeah.
That is Oscar. Oscar is a homeless person, basically, in the world of Sesame Street. That's what he stands in for. And the reason Oscar is important is because he makes that not seem not other, not scary. Oscar is as much a part of the community as anyone else there. He belongs there.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Sesame Street characters do. They operate on multiple levels. And with Bert and Ernie, it's never been hard to sort of figure out, like, the other meanings that Bert and Ernie can have. Like, when you're a kid, like for me at least, the first way I related to Bert and Ernie was Bert is the more childish pair. Like, the way Ernie tolerates and deals with Bert is an echo of the way a lot of people tolerate and deal with you when you're a kid, right? Like, when you're being a nuisance, you're a pest, you're curious. That's the first sort of thing you see embodied by Bert and Ernie. And as you get older, you start to realize, like, no, it's all, like, it's also about, like, how two people can love each other even if they don't always like each other.
Mm.
You know, it's, in many ways, like, Bert and Ernie are portraying, like, deep relationship dynamics. Marriage.
That's super
dynamics.
Intimate. Super intimate.
Yeah.
Living together. Yeah, live-in partners. Yeah.
Right. And so to turn around and say, like, obviously they're just puppets. Well, they're all just puppets, man. But they're all operating on multiple tiers of, like, analogy. And Bert and Ernie, it was not hard to parse what that is. And this notion that they're just there to teach preschoolers that you can be good friends with those who are different from you, that's the point of the Muppets. Like, they all do that. That is the point. It's a misfit band. Like, in Sesame Street and The Muppet Show, that's what Muppets do. They're all a bunch of misfits who are friends somehow despite that. Bert and Ernie, pretty clearly, are, like, in some kind of, like, intimate domestic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That's not hard to figure out what that is standing in for. And I think it's incredibly gross for Sesame Street to turn around and, when confronted with, like, the writer speaking pretty plainly about the text of the show, the text he wrote, and what its inspiration was, which is sort of modeled after the relationship he had with his partner, to turn around and say, like, well, you know, obviously that's absurd. These are Muppets, after all. It's somehow insulting both to, like, the body of work that is the Muppets and to gay people.
Yeah, yeah, I completely agree. And it's just ridiculous because, like, Kermit and Miss Piggy are very clearly in a relationship and are very clearly attracted to each other and display that attraction. It's not just like these are two people who are married. It's like these are two people who have a fondness for each other and have an attraction for each other. And, like, you know, like, it's just,
there's romance.
Romance. And although it wouldn't be, like, the worst, you know, like, if Bert and Ernie were, it's like, it doesn't do anything to just say that they are, you know what I mean? Like,
or to not knock down the, like, the,
yeah,
the, either to not knock down, like, the canon that, like, fans or certain fans have established, or even the subtext that the writer was putting in. Like, there's a corporatized version of that statement that is like, we're open to all sorts of interpretations of our characters and we celebrate the diversity of blah, blah. You know what I mean? Like, there's a world where it's like, okay, we get part of our funding. Maybe, you know, like they're worried about some sort of backlash. Like, you know, whatever, fuck you. Like, I think they should just come out and say it. But there's a version where it's like, okay, if you're not willing to go the complete mile, then at least don't knock, like, the people who have, like, this is what's different than Mario and Sesame Street, right? Like, the people have been helped by what they've been able to identify and see in Bert and Ernie, right? Like, that is not true for Mario and the Mushroom Kingdom. Maybe that person exists, and cool. I respect you, but, like, by knocking down those interpretations, in some ways you're knocking down those people and what those characters did for those people. And I think there was, like, such a much better way to handle this in which you can respect those interpretations of the characters, even if it's on a corporate level you are unwilling to go the full mile on acknowledging, like, the large understanding of what those characters and the different textual ways you can interpret them.
Well, and it's not like people were asking for, like, yo, so, like, when the camera's not rolling, totally Meet the Feebles at Sesame Street, right? Like, not what people are at. Like, that's not what people are asking for in terms of representation. Like, it's not like, well, you guys showed Miss Piggy and Kermit fucking. Like, that's never happened. That's not, like, that's, like, yes, they are puppets. This is where the limited, like, this is where, like, this is how puppets work as characters. And, again, if you've seen Meet the Feebles, gets really strange when you push what a puppet can do. It gets pretty fucking weird. Deeply, I do not like that movie. A lot of Peter Jackson's earlier films, I think, are dog shit.
Yeah,
but I think to answer your question from earlier about, like, why is there such a difference when, you know, seeing the headlines like Bert and Ernie, are they fucking, versus like Mario's nipples or whatever, like with Sesame Street, it is very much a, I don't know how to describe this, but it is children's programming.
It's like, for toddlers.
It is for toddlers. It is not, like, the things that it is teaching are like values and it is actively trying to teach things to very, very young children and to their benefit, to the society's benefit, let's say. Mario isn't necessarily have in the text that it's trying to teach us lessons about, you know, I don't know.
How to live our lives, right? Like, it's teaching you lessons. It's how to jump from platform A to platform B. How to get from job A to job B and, like, live a life that you feel is worth living. Like, it's just, like, the values embedded in, like, what the artifact is trying to, you know, the art is trying to do are just completely different. And it's also interesting because, like, this is a, when I saw this playing out, I couldn't help but think of, like, the increasingly, like, J.K. Rowling is a frustrating creator as someone who, like,
I thought
is
about
a
her too,
huge Harry Potter fan, like was like as fanboy as you can get about, like, those books. Every time I was at the midnight, like, releases, like, I was deeply
into. I didn't
into
know this.
Same.
Oh, wow, yeah, Patrick. Oh yeah, loved Harry Potter, like, loved the movies, like, I'm all Harry Potter. So, but what's just so frustrating about her and her approach to, like, that 7-book run afterwards is how she has handled, like, deeper text to the characters, right? Like, the most famous example is, like, after the fact saying, well, actually, Dumbledore was gay, even though there is, like, no real evidence for that in the books. Like, oh, he's gay, but you were unwilling to, like, mention that, show that, display that in the 7 run. You're just going to do this on Twitter after the fact.
And then that's one of her more textually supported claims about
you can go back yeah, right, she's done all sorts of this bullshit, and yes, you can go back and read into things, but it's still like he doesn't, like, kiss anyone, right? You know what I mean? Like, there's
he doesn't have a boyfriend,
right? And so I was thinking about this, and it's not and in the new movies where she has a blatant fucking opportunity to just make that in the text.
He's not gay in the new Johnny movies Depp either. Didn't want to do those scenes.
Okay, but yeah, well, like, that's a whole
Yeah, right?
Yep. So, the first movie was pretty good, though. But I was thinking of this relationship between, like, headcanon, fan canon, like author canon, like post, like a released of material, like retroactive canon. Like, it's just like, I was wondering, you know, how everyone else kind of thinks about, like, I think part of the reason people responded so negatively to that statement was the way, like, as I mentioned earlier, like the knocking down of fan canon. But like, there were all these different levels of canon. And I think a lot of the anxiety over this was like the uprooting of a particular view of the show, as opposed to just respecting those different ways. But like these days in 2018, like the amount of canons you have to keep track of are like a lot.
A ship full of cannons.
That's good. Very good. I think what's particularly painful, I don't know, because having J.K. Rowling going back and just saying, oh yeah, Dumbledore was gay, by the way, doesn't do, like, it doesn't, it's not, that's not like the it's like the bad flip side of what Sesame Street did, if that makes sense. It's like, oh, we're giving it to you, but we're giving it you absolutely, like, almost nothing to support it. And it is a character, first of all, Dumbledore sucked for, like, a lot. Like, most of those books, Dumbledore was, like, a bad person and was, like, extremely, you know, left. So the thing with the way that J.K. Rowling did it is by giving absolutely no evidence supporting this, like, sort of like post text revelation or whatever reveal, and then giving it to a character who is like so deeply, I don't know, it just like feels so wrong and so careless is really what it, like, it feels like she picked a name out of a hat. I was like, yeah, Dumbledore will be the gay one.
Like, there's right. There's a really interesting juxtaposition here, because I was thinking, as especially when Rob, you were saying, oh, the salacious portion of Bert and Ernie, the Bert and Ernie fucks part. Like, nobody was looking for that. That's like an old dog whistle, right, of making sexuality about sex. Mm-hmm. That's what, you know, all the anti-marriage protesters would say. Like, you're disgusting because you do these disgusting things, instead of focusing on something like a loving relationship that, you know, I'm not saying whether sex is a part of that or not. The point is, in terms of like the marriage argument for same-sex couples, was always like consenting adults should be able to make whatever contracts that they want, and loving relationships should be recognized, right? And so it's that whole aspect. This feels like the opposite of like, oh, this sexless, like, you know, like weird figure who's literally in the ivory tower all day. This sort of like bizarre. And again, I'm not the Harry Potter fan, so y'all can correct me. I've seen the movies and I read the last two books. So, all right, that's where I'm at with this. Mm-hmm. It always seemed to me that Dumbledore really was like alienated from the rest of humanity in a lot of ways, which almost feels like, to support your point, Dumbledore's the gay one? Like, okay, great. Thanks for also making that, like, a weird stereotype, too, of, like, this, like, very, like, alienated old man, basically. Like, alienated from the actual goings-on of his world or his society, which also feels, like, weird and gross, but on a that other level.
He is loveless, like, in a very strange way. And, I mean, his... You know, I mean, it's been a while since I've read the Harry Potter books. I was a super fan as well, Patrick. I participated in a lot of Harry Potter fandoms at a very young age, which was very not chill. But, the way that his relationship with Harry was not, you know, a father or grandfather or any, there's no, not even familial love between them. It is very much in this like self-serving, you know, raising
the priest preparing a sacrifice.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. I think of like I don't know. God, I don't know. It there is like sort of a religiosity to it in the way that you're talking about, Rob. And so it just feels, and that's a character who has no fucking future.
Right.
Like that he's like, spoilers, Dumbledore dies. Like, he's it's like the most, it's like such a silly, like, tragic, like, oh, he was gay and he never got to love anyone because he was too occupied trying to, like, stop evil. and, you know, or he was, you know, isolated himself and blah, blah, blah. It's just like, it feels so like arbitrary and just like kind of tacked on to his name. And that's what feels so disingenuous about it. And like, there are tons more characters in that book, in those books that like I've chosen and in different like fan canons have chosen to read as gay or as queer, at least.
Who's number one on the list? Ron?
Oh, Ron is straight. Ron is the straightest. Ron is the straightest and whitest character in those fucking books.
Ron is my straight ass bumbling ex.
God, I fucking hate that. Just, I hate fucking Ron so much. God damn it. He fucking sucks.
No, Natalie, give me. Okay, who is in your communities?
I can't go. Don't make me go back.
Come on.
Oh, I don't want to talk.
Who's
about
number one on the list?
You don't have to. If you want to share,
I'm gonna say it's not you. You're that's like what it was. I didn't run in these circles. Like I'm curious, like how the fans like which ones they read as in different ways.
I mean, obviously, there's been it's hard. It's hard to talk about this because it's like.
See, I know what I know what. Like vault Patrick is trying to crack open here because like I know what's behind that door and like it could be fucking anything too. that's the important thing is like the ships that like formed and like got a lot of like momentum behind them could be weird and surprising and sometimes you might think upsetting, but they made sense when you were much much younger.
Exactly. I think that's really the thing is that when I was much, much younger, you know, participating in these fandoms, I didn't really, I just wanted someone to be, I was kind of, I don't know, I guess I was like sort of like, I just want someone to be gay. So, I just want someone to be queer like me. Yeah. And I want to, you know, pretend that Hermione's queer. I don't know. But it's not, it's like, it is not supported.
Right.
And so it doesn't matter.
But that's also why it was so frustrating when she did that because
yeah.
It was like here's a bone like you know like it's like a feature list like
yeah. Gay, and again, it's been a really long time since I've reread the books, and I'm sure if I gave them, I've been meaning to do a reread soon.
Yeah, so have I. I've like before that that play comes stateside. Yeah. I've wanted to reread the books.
I was so bummed, by the way, when the co-writer on Cursed Child is apparently co-writing the his Dark Materials series for BBC and HBO. I was like, well, shit. That's gonna fucking suck.
His Dark Materials is like one of my favorite trilogies of all time, so I hope that I hope it doesn't doom it.
Yeah, yeah, mine too.
You want to watch Harry Potter, the take on the
right,
Christianity?
I don't think anyone involved with Cursed Child should be allowed within like 20 miles of Dark Materials. Like,
did you see or did you read like the like? Would you have strong opinions about the Cursed Child? I'm not saying I don't have any opinions. I didn't really read much about it.
Get into it later, but.
Right. Yeah, everyone's got some Harry Potter secrets on this podcast
today.
Everybody's
got some stuff going on.
But I think the Rowling case is interesting because, like, she wants credit for, like, the times changed around her. Like her series is, like, explicitly about, like England and Thatcherist politics. Like Harry Potter is a period piece. Like it didn't take place
90s, right?
90s. Yeah, and like yeah. Like somewhere. Harry's a kid, I think like a lot of the stories begin in the early 90s and a lot of the like when his parents were killed, I think it was like 1984 or something like that. So like
he's going to school during the 90s.
So he's my age.
He starts Hogwarts in like 1990 or something.
Okay. Right. And so like the books are both informed by those politics. And I think that makes them more interesting in a lot of ways. But also they're very much artifacts of entertainment when diversity, inclusion, representation of you know, marginalized and queer characters was not as important. It certainly wasn't fashionable back then. And
no.
Rowling was more than happy to write a series of stories that were easily interpretable is about a bunch of middle class to posh British kids going to boarding school and learning to be magic. And the only ones who were really bad were like cartoonishly shitty, like old aristocrats. That's broadly what that is about. Then the times change and Rowling sort of belatedly tries to like jump onto the bandwagon with, you know, actually, I never say Hermione is white. I love black Hermione. And it's like,
right.
Okay. Like, sure. But obviously not enough to make that canon. Right, like obviously not enough to dig into what that might mean for anything, and so Rowling's a case of like wanting like kudos or congratulations for belated and non-existent gestures towards
for
representation.
Just retconning.
For just not yeah for not saying anything in the first place, and then like she left it open, so yeah.
But Sesame Street's
Becky wants credit for being a good ally, is what it is.
Yeah,
but Sesame Street is in a different position because Sesame Street is quietly like political from the start, but in the sense that everything is political, right? Like Sesame Street is trying to create a world that teaches children positive ways of navigating contemporary society. Right. And it was always interesting to me, like right from the set of those early Sesame Streets, like Sesame Street was not like my neighborhood. Sesame Street took place in like a dense city. It wasn't the suburbs. And so fundamentally,
yeah, it's the same for
when
me.
I'd watch Sesame Street, I always thought like it was the coolest fucking thing. Like how awesome would it be to like live in a neighborhood?
The city seemed amazing.
Yeah, like holy shit, yeah. They got like a convenience store with like a cool guy like on the like right on the corner.
You just like walk down the street and there's and shit. Like you don't got to get in a car.
He'll like hang out with you and like chat and like give you like paper clips and stuff. Like that's awesome. And that was a choice even then. They make a series that's not for suburban kids. They make Sesame Street, you know, they're not saying it doesn't have like instrumental political purpose, but it has a politics. And yeah, it's so disappointing to see that legacy sort of tainted by a much more modern corporatist, like, you know, don't really have an opinion about anything. Version of Sesame Street, when that is so clearly, that's the retconning, turning around and saying Sesame Street doesn't have politics, doesn't have real
right.
world.
It's yeah, the opposite.
That's the
there
shift.
Was subtext. They did the work and then are trying to strip it of that as a you know, the opposite of Harry Potter. Yeah, that's deeply frustrating.
Yeah, there's a great piece and I'll put it in the show notes because I can't link it right now, that also has to do with sort of how really deep Sesame Street kind of used to be, like in the 70s and 80s, they went after topics like how to deal with a death, things that were very, very difficult, but that a child might have to deal with in their life. And the character of Big Bird being a sort of stand-in for like the emotional intelligence of a six-year-old or thereabouts, and how a six-year-old would deal with certain things. Like, why is this person not in my life anymore? Like, where'd they go? Like, there's a really serious episode of this show that like really goes in deep on that. And this article goes against the sort of Elmoification of the show as well, of being like a little bit more surface level, a little bit more about the singing and dancing than necessarily the sort of like, all right, we're going to sing, we're going to dance, we're going to have a lot of fun, we're going to be very colorful, but also we're going to get into some shit.
Also,
here.
They
like Sesame Street.
They
goes
sure
in.
Gentrified Sesame Street. Like just like looking at the sets did. Today versus like what it was when I was a kid, it's like what happened? And It's like
Brooklyn yeah. for real. It's like it used to look like Brooklyn. Now what Brooklyn looks yeah. like, you know, yeah, very. It's upsetting. Very, very upsetting. I think we can all agree that Bert and Ernie can do whatever the hell they want, and they were super gay, and I'm gonna keep thinking that no matter what, and it's fine. And also, it's funny when Mario characters are used in hilarious adult situations.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Agreed.
I think we've all learned something here today. Okay. Unless there's anything else on sort of the way children's media is sort of used in this way, or the way that family-friendly, because I wouldn't call Mario children's media by any means, and we already made that distinction, but the way sort of family-friendly media in that way can be kind of used. Unless there are any other thoughts on this, we can go to the question bucket.
Let's hit that bucket.
All right, this bucket was a this bucket question. It is kind of a comment, but it's a story.
God damn it!
It's a story. No, it's a story. It's a cute story. It's not really cute. It's an interesting story. But it's nobody who's a major expert in Bill O'Reilly this time. So that's
I'm just kidding.
That's all right. All right, here we go. Settle in, friends. Hi, Waypointers. In the last episode of the podcast, you talked about games with lore that worked and some that didn't. I have to say the most baffling use of lore in a game I've ever experienced was Quantum Break. For the entirety of that game, it's a light, bland sort of attempt to make a sci-fi TV show like The Fringe or X-Files into a game. The main character is generic, and you learn almost nothing about him. All of the in-story stuff just seems to be very by the numbers. There's one character named Beth. She's not in the game, she's not in a lot of the game, and I took her to be a wooden stand-in like a lot of the other characters. Then right before you step through a time machine, you see a notebook you can read. There have been dozens of objects like this, and they've been unimportant. As I start to read this notebook, it becomes clear that this is something she was given when she was very young, and it lays out every single important thing that will ever happen to her. The thing that was striking was not how important it was to the plot of the game, but how much it wasn't. This is a guide on how to be the person you want to be when you grow up. At times, it is literally the letter of encouragement you wish you could write to your younger self at their lowest moment. The kind of reassurance that purpose and certainty give us that we rarely actually get in real life. But it's also an omen of mistakes and deaths that she can never do anything to change. And there's two entries from this diary. October 3rd, 2000. Derek Stevenson has been bullying you for months. On October 3rd, you will push him down the staircase at school. You do everything in your power to resist this, partly to avoid the consequences, partly to prove this book wrong, but the terrible things he will say in that moment will be too much for you to handle. He'll pretend to cry, claim that you gave him a concussion, and you'll take all the blame. You'll be transferred to another school. You'll hope things will get better. They won't. It's going to be a difficult year. Whenever you feel helpless, just remember this book. You are special. You have a purpose that they don't. Hold on to that. And if it makes you feel better, 16 years from now, Derek will be working at a dollar store. He still lives with his mom. Next entry. December 3rd, 2000. Mr. Hartsbrook from next door will pass away. I came away from this notebook shaken. I was not expecting this sort of depth and vulnerability from Quantum Break. And from this, a book that you could completely miss. But then it took a turn. Something happens and you get separated from Beth in the time travel. When you land back in 2010, you find out she's been stuck in the wrong time for 11 years, and in that time, she's become the strong, purpose-filled woman that gave herself the notebook as a kid. And here she is now, a failure for the most part. You find a journal that she's kept for these 11 years, and it's the total opposite. What do you do when you become the person you've always strived to be? And what happens when you find out that it's not what you've always dreamed of? The character you've come to know is totally broken, and all it took was time. This all happens in the course of about 10 minutes in two Word documents. Soon after, the character of Beth is no longer in the story, and we go back to TV Town. It's still such a bizarre thing to have laying around a game that is so weak in comparison. He sent links and then says, thanks for everything you do, Justin in Austin. Beth.
I mean, that's that. The fact that there is a like total separation in like a notebook, like versus the rest of the game is not super shocking when you think about the way video game production and video game writing often works. Video game writers are, you know, when I've talked to writers that have worked on those sort of like separate, like environmental documents, a lot less oversight. You're given a lot more freedom. Yeah. You know, you're given just a much larger playbook because you're not interfering with the assets of a game, right? So you can write whatever you want into those lines, and as long as it doesn't, you know, break the story, you're not like changing the level that someone has spent the last, you know, 9 months designing and polishing up. So it's always nice when I think games find ways to either like, you know, increase the level of detail for like a side character or just kind of like do a tonal shift, because like that's a spot where you can be expressive that doesn't have nearly as much of an impact on like the production of a game that is usually very expensive and lots of people touching on a single thing. Like that's one of the rare instances in a video game where it's just a piece of paper and a person writing, and like you can do a lot more in that than in other elements where you have tens or hundreds of people and teams and money. Like, it's just you and a piece of paper, and that's cool that person, that writer found a way to do something interesting.
I wonder, though, like, if that's the case with this game, because this is a Sam Lake game, right? This is Remedy.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder to what degree, like, is this a case where somebody just had some room to run, or is this the one of the signatures of Sam Lake making the kind of games that Remedy makes, which is like, oh yeah, we got a huge story Bible and we're going to litter tons of breadcrumbs around the world to inform it, even though the story is going to let a lot of this sort of lie fallow, especially in Quantum Break, which has this weird dichotomy. Like, there's the TV show part and the video game part that don't speak to each other all that much. Like, Beth is not a character you run across in the game part too much, but I want to say she's in a lot of like the TV show stuff. It's a very strange thing, but it's one of the things that I've always liked about Remedy's games, particularly I think the Max Payne games had a little bit of this. You know, you'd find, you know, there were the TVs showing like little shows in the world, and that stuff was kind of nifty. You had the sort of winking self-awareness of the graphic novel cutscenes, most notably where there's a cutscene where Max Payne tells himself like you're a video game character. But in Alan Wake,
it's a Max Payne 2, right?
No, it's Max Payne 1.
Is that 1? Oh, okay.
Max Payne, not Max Payne. Alan Wake is where it starts to get really layered, in that there is Alan Wake's career as a shitty TV writer. Well, not necessarily shitty, but like certainly not a thriving one anymore. And so he's surrounded by like the Twilight Zone knockoff fandom that he used to be involved with. Then there's his career as a genre detective novelist. And then there's sheets of paper from his supposed masterwork that has basically come to life and is eating the town of Bright Falls in Alan Wake. And then that approach, I think, evolves even more with Quantum Break, which has tons of this extraneous material. Like, Quantum Break, I think, even has like little diagrams and stuff from other characters. You find their notebooks, sort of like where they're laying out the causalities that have brought about this like time travel catastrophe. I don't know. This is one of the reasons why I love these fucking games, even though so many of them are so very flawed. I love them because of these little nuggets, and that's kind of what captivates me.
Yeah. I'm the same way as a player. We've definitely discussed it at times, but I live and die by the details of a world a lot of times in a game that has a world, basically. If it's not just like a puzzle game where there is no fiction or no, you know, that kind of thing. Live and die by it. Just love that stuff. Natalie, go ahead.
It is so nice to actually, I feel like there is almost a good side to the story being kind of contained in the small space, because it is like just, you know, a moment that you get to be a part of. And unfortunately, or I don't know, a lot of games take place over so many moments that like a lot of things can be lost in like, you know, in lore, in just like so many conversations and things like that, like things get lost. It's like the lore talk we had last week about, you know, being overloaded with that sort of thing. But being able to just sort of stumble upon this thing and like and find it and just spend this like significant moment with it is kind of special, because it is unintentional, and that's what makes it surprising, and that's what makes it like feel, you know, that's what makes it stand out in that time. So I think it's, you know, pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. Shout outs to Beth.
Shout outs to Beth. Shout outs to Justin.
Shout outs to Justin and Beth. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Justin from Austin.
That's right. Good times. All right. I think that's probably going to do it for us today. I think that was a good story to end on. It's very, very nice. Thank you, Justin. If you have questions, comments, or great stories, you can send those to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. Shout-outs, as always, to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. We're on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. We're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice. We're on twitch.tv/Waypoint. And you can read everything that we write at waypoint.vice.com. Natalie, where can we find you on this grand internet of ours?
If you'd like, you can find me on Twitter at Natalie Watson. Thank you.
Patrick, where can we find you?
You can find me at dick.
Yeah, that's where we can find you. That's a lot.
Yeah, could you spell that for me, actually?
How many of those?
Dick. I can count the waveforms. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. 13 okay. dicks.
That's 13 good. Dicks. Thank you very much.
Good. Very good.
At 13 dicks.
Very good. Thank you. Rob, where can we find you online?
At Rob Zachney.
Amazing. If you want to, you can find me at Danielle R.I. And I will leave you with this one thought this weekend as you think about whatever you do, where it regards to Mario characters and Sesame Street characters and all of the above. And that is, be good. And be good at it.
Dick.
You know who wasn't being good or good at it? Was Ernie when he painted a portrait of Bert. Sometimes I'm not sure about the health of their relationship dynamics.
Yeah, sometimes.
Like, is it all positive, though? I don't know.
Yeah.
But hey, that's
Look,
love.
Everybody has fights.
Next week on Waypoint Radio.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.